This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, we'll visit with Kevin Kane, the head of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. Kevin Kane is trying to coax lawmakers into passing legislation that would reduce sentences and get people out of jail on drug offenses much earlier and alleviate some burden for taxpayers. We'll talk with him about whether this is feasible at the legislature. Also, Michael Wolff, the noted libertarian attorney on a few different matters. He says the Vance McAllister episode has been blown way out of proportion. The congressman deserves a break. Also, Michael Wolff on why we are celebrating a religious holiday with state workers having the day off. And Iolette Waldman, a fabulous novelist with her new book, Love and Treasure. We'll talk about it. But first, the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Your numbers are 297-5633. And if you're calling outside Baton Rouge, 877-217-5757. And you may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Glad you're spending Good Friday with us. And we start with Kevin Kane. He is the president of the Public Policy Institute, the Pelican Institute for Public Policy in New Orleans. And Kevin Kane, before the session, was with us to discuss the legislative session and attempts at criminal justice reform. And there are a number of bills that are being bandied about and discussed and debated at the state capitol. And Kevin Kane is on the forefront of pending legislation. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you.
Well, how's it going?
Well, things have been going pretty well. We've been working hard on this issue of criminal justice reform, and we have a package of about 9 bills that we had filed this session, and almost all of them are sort of sailing along without much opposition, and so we're very pleased with that. But we have a bill coming up for a hearing on Tuesday. Senate Bill 323, which focuses on the penalties for simple possession of marijuana. And I think this is a very important bill and will probably be receiving a lot of attention this week.
297-5633 for Kevin Kane of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. So what would you do as far as reducing sentences for those who are convicted of possessing marijuana?
Well, basically what this bill does is very simple. I mean, it just says that simple possession of marijuana is still against the law, but it would be a misdemeanor. Currently, it's a misdemeanor on your first offense, but on subsequent offenses, it's elevated to a felony. So for your second offense, you can receive up to 5 years in jail. For a third offense, you can receive up to 20 years in jail. I think whatever you may think of marijuana use, I just don't think that many people would really think of simple possession as meriting a felony. And when you look at where we stand in relation to other states, even sort of southern kind of conservative states, our penalties are just totally out of whack.
We have the highest rate of incarceration of our people in the United States. And at a cost to the taxpayers of Louisiana, what does it cost on average to house a prisoner for a year in one of our fine institutions?
Well, really, it depends on where they're being housed. In a Department of Corrections state facility, it's probably about $20,000. It's less than that if they're held in a parish jail, which typically has less programming, and the facilities are don't have as much there. If you sort of kind of compare it to things, some cases we're spending more on incarcerating people than we are on, say, higher education. And granted, there, we have about 40,000 people incarcerated, and I'm sure a lot of them we would never want to get out. I'm certainly not saying that everybody who's in jail, or even a majority of people who are in jail, don't belong there. But we have very tough drug sentencing laws, and there are a lot of people in our jails who have never been convicted of a violent crime, and so don't necessarily need to be there. What we're seeing in other states is that alternatives to incarceration often have better outcomes than incarceration, and in the long run actually prove to be much cheaper. So I think that's sort of the direction we need to be moving in.
David Indestrahan notes that the Sheriff's Association has apparently not come on board with your proposals. Is that an impediment?
Well, it is. I mean, you know, first off, the sheriffs, is, as you probably know, are a very powerful force in Baton Rouge. And we have kind of a unique setup here in Louisiana in that about half of the state prisoners are held in local facilities, which are run by the sheriffs. And so the sheriffs get per diem money from the state for holding those for those inmates. And so in many cases, what you have is this has become sort of a reliable income stream. And, you know, the more people you've got, the more money you're getting from the state. And you've even got situations where, you know, facilities have been built or people have been hired on the expectation of a certain income stream. Now, I'm not, you know, there are a lot of people who will sort of paint the sheriffs as villains, and I wouldn't do that. I mean, the sheriffs are doing what they were asked to do. If they weren't housing these people, you know, we would have had to go out and build new facilities, which costs a lot of money. So, you know, it's not that the sheriffs have done something wrong here, but at the same time, I mean, we need to acknowledge this reality that we have a financial incentive in place that I think most of us would acknowledge is not really healthy. And so I think it's critical in the long run that we really look at that and find a way to address that, because I think as long as you have people who are really financially relying on this income stream, I think you're going to have sort of a built-in opposition to these sorts of reforms. So I think that in the long run, that's something we really need to look at.
297-5633 in our remaining time with Kevin Kane, who is president of the Pelican Institute for Public Policy. He's right on Magazine Street in New Orleans, and he is following what's going on at the legislature. And he is speaking from a conservative bent, and some would say this is a bit unusual for a conservative, anti-crime person to be so steadfast in supporting reduced sentences on some level.
Yeah, I mean, it's people are often interested and kind of wonder how that came about. And I think there are a few things here. I mean the one thing that, of course, conservatives tend to be sort of you know, fiscally conservative and sort of concerned about staying within the budget and that sort of thing. And just looking at the dollars and cents of it, I mean, what we've been spending on incarceration has skyrocketed over the years. And that's one reason why a lot of sort of Republican states like Texas and Georgia and Mississippi have looked at this and found that there's a better and less expensive way to deal with this. But really, I mean, I don't think that a concern for justice is a partisan issue. I mean, there may be differences. In some cases, liberals and conservatives may have different priorities or different ideas about what is just and what is right. But I mean, I think most people, regardless of their politics, you know, takes this question of who should be incarcerated very seriously. And so those of us who have started to look at this and kind of look at how other states are dealing with this, I mean, you just can't ignore the evidence that a lot of these nonviolent offenders do much better with alternatives to incarceration than they do with being locked up for a period of years. So there really is, it's remarkable what broad bipartisan support there is for these sorts of reforms, and very encouraging.
Now, this week, a Senate panel advanced a bill sponsored by Dan Clater of Baton Rouge to impose 99-year sentences for heroin distribution. Is that a positive sign, or is that overkill?
You know, I have not studied that bill, so I can't take a position on that bill per se. I would say, I mean, two things. First, our bill, which focuses on marijuana, I mean, marijuana and heroin, I think, are considerably different in that, I mean, there really is a danger associated with heroin that in most cases is not there with marijuana. Again, whatever you think of marijuana, and whether it's any sort of a gateway drug or anything, I mean, it's simply not deadly the way that heroin is. And there has been a problem around the state with deaths associated with heroin. And the other thing is our bill, which is focusing on simple possession, And that's very different than someone who's dealing drugs, which I think most people would agree is a much more serious violation. So, you know, I can't really say whether I agree with that bill or not, but I think he is trying to address a much more serious problem than simple possession of marijuana. I will say that as kind of a general matter, we do need to be really careful about laws that impose mandatory minimum sentences, because that's certainly one of the things that's fueled the growth of our prison population, is in many cases judges don't have any flexibility to sort of respond to the unique facts of each case. And so in some cases, people who have done something wrong, but maybe haven't done anything that bad or really don't pose a real threat to society, are being put away for a long time. So, you know, in general, I just think we ought to be real careful about sentences that don't allow for any flexibility.
Yeah, there are, I think, 10 people in the state serving life sentences for possession of marijuana. Your nine-bill package, what are some of the other items that you're attempting to accomplish in this session?
Well, when we put this package together, we wanted to kind of have a broad range of reforms on the table, because one of the things we're trying to do is just sort of educate people on these issues. I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, first of all, for conservatives, this is sort of a new issue for a lot of us. And so, you know, we've got a Republican majority in the legislature. A lot of legislators just haven't heard these arguments before and may not be aware of what states like Texas, Georgia, and now Mississippi are doing. And so we wanted to have a diverse set of reforms to sort of introduce people to this. And so we've got a couple of bills, what we call opening doors to the workforce. So, you know, making it easier for ex-offenders to get into the workforce. We have a bill that would provide for provisional occupational licenses for certain ex-offenders. Because what you hear is there'll be situations where someone who's in jail, you know, maybe they'll learn how to cut hair or something while they're in prison, and then when they get out, they can't get a barber license, you know, because they're banned from getting a license because they're an ex-offender. And so we want to make it easier for people to get those sorts of occupational licenses. We're also looking to expand the alternatives to incarceration. Senator Guillory authored a veterans court program, a bill, which is sort of an alternative program for veterans who may have drug or substance abuse issues or mental health issues. And maybe they've broken the law, but rather than just, you know, incarcerating them when that may not be necessary, the veterans courts will sort of direct them to different federal programs that might be available to veterans, and kind of make it easier for them to be rehabilitated and reintegrated into the community. We also have a couple of bills that would expand parole eligibility, in one case medical parole, like making more people eligible for medical parole. And then we had a couple of sentencing reform bills, one of which is the marijuana bill. Another thing that I think is very important is Walt Leger is authoring a bill which actually is being converted into a study resolution, which will focus on how to kind of measure cost savings from reduced incarceration and then plugging some of those savings into funding alternatives to incarceration. And that really, I think, is going to be the key in the long term, because that is what these other states are doing. And, you know, if we're not going to incarcerate as many people, we need to have kind of beefed up parole capacity. So,
all right. I do want to ask you before we leave, Kevin, what about the governor? Is he supportive? You're probably going to have to get his signature if any number of these bills pass. Will he back reduced sentences and look potentially soft on crime when he runs for president?
You know, I'm very optimistic that that he will support these. First of all, he's back in 2011, there were two or three bills, reform bills that the governor supported and signed. And, you know, he definitely understands this kind of movement among conservatives for criminal justice reform. And, you know, while he hasn't really made it a priority issue this year, he has been speaking about it more and more. I mean,
all right, we've got to roll, but thank you, Kevin Kane. Good luck, and we will talk soon, I hope. And we shall return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, Inkster's show at WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. Glad you're with us on Good Friday. Frank Barnett is producing, and in studio now is the noted libertarian attorney Michael Wolff, who not so long ago on this show got folks revved up about his statements regarding the embattled Congressman Vance McAllister. And we'll get to that, but Michael Wolff is a libertarian, and I think you once identified yourself on this show as a Buddhist. Would that be accurate?
Yes, that's true, yes.
So does that mean you believe in a God, but not the Christian God that we're observing today?
No, Buddhists generally do not believe in a creator God at all. Basically, Alan Watts called it atheism in the name of God. But it's basically a free-thinking philosophy and moral ethical system in which one uses his own mind as the starting point
analysis. So I could call you an atheist and you would not be offended.
That's correct.
And Edwin Edwards sat right in that chair you were in not so long ago and indicated that he is an atheist. But yet, when Edwin Edwards was governor, he let state workers off on Good Friday. Today, state workers are taking the day off. We're one of only 11 states that does this, but in Louisiana, we obviously are observing a religious holiday at taxpayer expense. Is this a violation of the Constitution of the United States of America?
Well, that's a complicated question because the Supreme Court's rulings, and most people tend to agree with it, have emphasized that in the area of church-state relations, there needs to be an analysis that sees studies whether the law in question causes the state to be too involved with religion or promotes a particular religion too much or inhibits the free practice of religion too much. So it's like a seeking a middle way, which is a Buddhist idea, between opposing concepts. You don't want to promote religion too much and you don't want to inhibit its practice. The court has recognized that traditional feasts like Christmas, holidays, have achieved a secular characterization, really. They're not purely religious holidays. They're public holidays. They're social holidays.
All right. Maybe you could make a case and a strong one for that on Christmas, but yes. Good Friday is about the death of Jesus Christ.
Exactly, and I was about to say that basically it is much more of a theologically centered holiday than Christmas. It doesn't have the secular association, so you can easily make an argument that the state should not be observing Good Friday. And if it were to, for example, you could make an argument that we should recognize the holidays of other major religions.
Yes. As a Christian, I think this should not be a holiday.
Well, that makes sense. In fact, there are too many holidays to honor them all with days off.
But you and I are working today.
Well, sure. I think maybe there should be a study of this. Really, this would be an ideal thing for a committee, a multi-culti group, to get together and figure out what would be suitable holidays that would honor all religious disciplines, all religious traditions.
But my guess is that there are many atheists, there's some Jews, there's some Muslims, Buddhists working for the state who today probably aren't complaining a whole lot about not going to work.
Well, that's right. I asked my wife about this topic before coming over here, and she said, well, we need holidays. She's a school teacher. But anyway, there shouldn't be discrimination among religions in designing holidays, basically. I think we could possibly reexamine the whole holiday schedule. For example, do we need a holiday for the Battle of New Orleans and so forth?
Well, that is obviously a secular thing.
Yes.
But yeah. This goes right to the root of separation of church and state. And a lot of people, particularly from the left, they complain about any violation of separation of church and state, but rarely complain about this, which is clearly a violation of separation of church and state.
Oh, that's true. There's no doubt that it reflects a Christian bias. And when you speak about Good Friday, the whole premise of it is that it celebrates the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which is something that I firmly am convinced did not happen. So when we talk about education in the state and what values we inculcate in our citizens, our children, and so forth, here we are encouraging belief in a religious superstition.
Well, that's your opinion. It's one that many of us do not share. And I'm all for people taking this day off as a vacation day. But not as a state holiday, not at taxpayer expense. No.
I would agree with that.
297-5633. Mike in Sherwood. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, I was going to point out that my company has an interesting policy on this issue. Instead of specifying which holidays are taken by their employees, they simply say, as part of their policy manual, that employees may take up to 5 holiday days a year, pick and choose.
Hold on, Mike. I think there's some merit to that, but on the other hand, many companies need a cohesive unit. And when you've got some employees taking Mardi Gras off and some taking Good Friday off and some taking Martin Luther King Day off, it can cause some chaos in the staff, can't it?
No. I would say that I agree that, you know, in a heavily Catholic area, for example, or a heavily Christian area, you might have a large number of people off. And I guess you could go ahead and have a policy that if that occurs, then the business won't operate that day because of lack of coverage or some other mechanism, or, you know, maybe people share half days of work. So, you know, I mean, how does Walmart function 365 days a year, you know? I think it's a much more equitable and free-minded approach than simply saying these days are holidays and let it go at that.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Appreciate your call.
Bye.
Richard in Lafayette. Hello, Richard. You're on the air with Mike Wolf.
Hello? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. I just wanted to clarify something that was said at the beginning of the show, and that was about Buddhism. Buddhism has no problem with God. Their position specifically is that God's unknowable. Therefore, they don't talk about it, but they have no problem with anybody having individual beliefs.
Okay.
They're not an atheist religion, in other words.
Well, he certainly he's right that the Buddhists have no problem with other people's beliefs. But I heard the Dalai Lama himself describe Buddhism as denying belief in a creator God. And the point is, agnosticism is a strange subject, and you can describe all beliefs as agnostic, and that might be a more helpful description for some people.
Thank you, Richard. 297-5633, and thanks, everybody, for joining us on Good Friday. Bob from Parts Unknown. Hi, Bob. You're on the air with Michael Wolf.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes. You said that Edwards stated that he was an atheist?
He stated that he did not believe in a higher power.
Well, I said I didn't believe in a creator God.
We were talking about Edwin Edwards.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he sure used religion to get elected last time he was governor.
And every other time, and he acknowledged that.
Yeah.
So he's a hypocrite.
He's waffling.
A politician being a hypocrite? Imagine that. So what do you think? You think that he's unfit for office because he doesn't believe in a God?
You need to say one thing and stick to it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bob.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
That just points out a problem, though, in defining religious beliefs and establishing them. You can't prove them. They're matters of speculation, and it becomes difficult to hold people to vague standards.
Okay. Well, speaking of lawmakers doing things that are inexplicable, the House, the Louisiana House, voted 67-27 this week to keep an unconstitutional anti-sodomy law on the books, which applies not only to gay people, but to straight people, to married couples. Many of these lawmakers may very well be violating the law themselves, but yet they voted largely for keeping the law as is. Michael Wolf, how do you explain this?
Well, here's something that's against my religion. You can people describe religion as a rationalistic religion. It's based on reason. That's part of what I was trying to express earlier. Now, the legislature is taking a totally unreasonable position. There's no legal basis. There's no moral basis. There's no rational basis for restricting private consensual behavior. And here they are saying stubbornly, like animals with their heads in the sand, that they're just not going to change. They don't care what intelligence would indicate. that it's crazy. Why won't they repeal that law? It's just a mindless law that's based on ignorance and prejudice against homosexuals.
It is designed to single out homosexuals, as we saw by these arrests in Baton Rouge. Some lawmakers claim these parks are just teeming with homosexual activity. My guess is that there are as many heterosexuals as there are homosexuals in our parks, doing things that perhaps would be better done behind closed doors. But Mike Wolf, 67 lawmakers voted to keep a law on the books that the U.S. U.S. Supreme Court has said is unconstitutional. Obviously, the Family Forum packs a wallop at the Capitol.
Right, and obviously, these so-called conservatives don't know much about the Constitution. They claim to be defenders of the Constitution, but they don't even know what it means, what that implies, in how they treat the other people. By the way, though, those laws were used against heterosexuals, too, as you implied in your introduction. I can remember some years back when in New Orleans they were sending out police decoys with prostitutes and people that consort with them to try to arrest people for oral sex acts, commercial acts of oral sex, and that was considered crime against nature. Now, if that's unnatural, they'd talk about a cognitive dissonance. They're trying to criminalize something that's universal.
Well, we're fascinated with sex, particularly when other people have it. And the Louisiana legislature obviously wants to have some say on who can have sex and how they can do it. And the people at large have been enthralled by this Vance McAllister story, not to be confused with Ralph McAllister, Vance McAllister. What do you were on this show not so long ago and said that you thought he was getting a lot of treatment that was unwarranted, that, you know, give the guy a break. Have you had a chance to talk with your wife and get another point of view on this?
No, my views haven't changed on that. And the main thing I was saying was that that was a private matter, and that it the people involved were the only ones who should have should be outraged or concerned one way or the other about it. The general public should not. And that to call this man a hypocrite required a very clear understanding, that one that I do not have, of what his professed beliefs are and of what they have been in his political campaign and so forth. I think the state is filled with busybodies, and so is the country. And basically, and you mentioned the talk about other people having sex. I really believe at the root of it is, for a lot of people, is basically resentment that some people are getting more sex than they are. And so they come out very strongly against adultery and fornication and promiscuity and so forth, and try to act very proper and until they have an opportunity to behave otherwise. But
well, our visit was short last time, and you were just getting revved up. But as the more you talked, I began to get the impression, tell me if I'm wrong, that you believe a man of Mr. McAllister's caliber, he's a congressman and a successful business person, that he's pretty much entitled to have as much sex with anybody he wants without us casting judgment.
Basically, I agree with that. I think simply think it's a private matter. It's no one else's concern, as long as he's not being harmful to someone. Now, of course, when you get into changing sexual relationships and so forth, and possibly in violating personal expectations, then you can cause harm. But we can't stand back and make a blanket judgment of all acts of promiscuity. You need to know the individual situation. So I simply say it's outlandish to jump on him so much unless you knew just what's going on. If maybe you were his wife or you were his friend whose wife he was dealing with, you could say something meaningful about it. But otherwise, you can't, unless he's going around saying otherwise.
Right. Well, in that videotape, it appears that Miss Peacock is enjoying herself, but her husband, Heath Peacock, his only quote to my knowledge on this is, "I'm freaking devastated."
Well, again, go to family court. They put iron metal detectors on the family court floor of the courthouse long before they did in the criminal section. Nothing excites passions more than marital conflicts. If we're going to civilize this society, we need to start making people a bit more open-minded. And that last program, we also talked about societies that have a more open attitude towards sexual relations. There's some that practice what they call polyamory. They're polygamous societies, they're polygynous societies, and everyone doesn't think the way European and American Christians do about but sex.
You're okay with polyamory?
Yes, I am. I'm for free love. Basically, it should be spontaneous. I'm not saying people should not be loyal to their spouses and significant others, but I'm saying that one size doesn't fit all. Look at the polygamous groups in the West. They're very serious about it. They've even put it on television, and they're celebrating it. And if I say that if these people, if it floats their boat, if they get along with it, if they can live that way, well, let them do it. No one should give them any grief about it.
Well, there are people in our community who practice open relationships, but rarely does somebody run for public office and say, I have a wife, and I have a mistress, and I have other girlfriends. Generally, that's not good for business, Mike.
Well, I agree, because, again, and it is natural that people favor persons who share their values, and so they are more inclined to support people who are more like them. But I'm just saying we need to loosen up a little and be a little more tolerant and don't just condemn people out of hand because they have too much sex.
Well, Vance McAllister has become one of the best-known congressmen in America in the last 11 days. And another story today in the Washington Post about the guy that the Advocate calls Vance Romance. He looks like he's perhaps been listening to you. Perhaps he is listening online. And he's going to dig in and stay the course, certainly serve out the rest of his term, and perhaps run for re-election.
Well, not certainly. I think when you're evaluating the behavior of a politician in office, you should be mainly concerned about his work as a representative, as a representative of the people, and his public service. What has he accomplished? What is he doing? What is he articulating in terms of public policy? It shouldn't be based on his personal sexual behavior.
Would you say the same thing for David Vitter?
Yes, I would, yes, and for Edwin Edwards and every other person whose sexual behavior is somewhat in the public light.
Well, Edwin Edwards, I think he acknowledged that he had extramarital liaisons during at least his first marriage, and lots of them, but the people didn't seem to mind because he was open about it. The biggest sin here may be the hypocrisy.
Well, I was just going to say that, yes, and hypocrisy certainly is an issue, and you wouldn't want hypocrisy in a public official as much as you could avoid it. But, of course, hypocrisy runs in politics like oxygen, you know, on Earth. But anyway, and that's why I said I couldn't critique McAllister very well unless I knew more about what assertions he had made. I'm not going to assert he's a hypocrite just because I know he claims to be a Christian, because there are lots of Christians who love more than one person.
Well, you're a guy, and here you're cheering this man on. A listener says, would you be doing the same thing, for example, if Edwin Edwards' beautiful wife, who's 51 years his junior, was involved with other people? Would you think that's okay, too?
Again, it's up to them, yes. I don't think it doesn't, it's not up to me to make those decisions. It doesn't bother me at all what they choose to do in that regard.
297-5633. Back with the outspoken Mike Wolf in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Mike Wolf, the attorney, who says Vance McAllister should be allowed to serve, that his sexual indiscretion should not be an issue, that people should vote for him or against him based on other issues. But it did sound to me that you have kind of a grudging respect for this guy, that you might actually vote for him as a result of this, Mike, if you were in that district.
No. I don't think that would be accurate, not for him. I would have voted for him over Reiser in the race that elected him, but I don't know enough about him. I saw that debate I mentioned the last time on LPB, and it wasn't very enlightening. It wasn't very complimentary to either one of the candidates.
David at White Oak Landing. Good morning, David. You're on with Michael Wolf.
Yes, hi, Michael. Hi. I generally agree with your views on what you're talking about right now with privacy, should be privacy, but I wanted to go back to the previous issue about the legislature and their what everybody's characterizing as a stupid vote. And I think everybody's missing the point here. these people are not voting to repeal this because they're afraid their constituencies will connect them with gays and lesbians as supporters. And I think that's why they're not doing the right thing in repealing this law. And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Well, I think he's right, yes. Well, but I think there are two things. The main thing is what he said. They're afraid that they'll become unpopular with some of the voters. But the other reason is that they don't care enough about the people who are there impacting with the legislation to trample their rights.
But a guy like Steve Carter, for example, who's in his 70s, a former tennis coach at LSU, former associate AD, considered to be progressive on some issues, he voted. He was one of the 67. He's probably only going to run for one more term at the most. If you're going to lose an election on something like this, is it really worth serving?
Yeah, well, yes. And what, again, we're looking for integrity. I'm more concerned about people following the Constitution and respecting constitutional rights, respecting their constituents and their neighbors, than I am following arbitrary sexual standards. My representative, too, Eric Ponte, voted for that thing, or voted not to change the law. And anyone who says, I'm too scared of losing the bigot vote, should not be in the legislature.
Well, the lawmakers, remember a few years back, voted for the teaching of creation science in public school classrooms. Only three Louisiana lawmakers voted against it.
Well, yeah, and there's another perfect example of touching on education and, gosh, dealing squarely with it. How can these people fulfill their responsibilities when they're going to bend to the views of religious fanatics and they'll distort the whole agenda of public education to avoid offending a religious outgroup, or well, it may be the main group, but a religious group that should not be controlling educational policy.
Well, getting back to our original point, as we close it out with Michael Wolff, he and others think today should not be a state holiday, that it is a religious holiday. If you want to take the day off, that's your business, but taxpayers shouldn't be subsidizing a religious holiday. But on the other hand, do you have contempt for those who believe other than you?
No, I don't. But I really think that we should recognize, though, the relativity of religious belief, and we should celebrate the variety of religious belief available to us. For example, it would be very helpful, I think, to the society if we all got better acquainted with the religious beliefs of other groups, such as the Baha'is, the Hindus, the Muslims, the different groups, different forms of Taoism, Buddhism, Christianity. Mm-hmm. Basically, comparative religion. We should be studying comparative religion more, and so that we come to an understanding of the universal aspects of religious belief. And that's where the real core of spirituality is. It's not in revealed religions, in the religions of the book, but it's in the religion that comes out of the human mind.
We're short on time with Mike, and we won't be able to get to all the inquiries online and by phone, but let's go. I'm going to pick one from Frank Barnett. He says, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. So, Phil, it's all yours. The floor is yours on Good Friday.
Well, good morning, and thank you, Jim. I have to say that I was raised in public schools here in Louisiana. There's some pretty good ones in New Orleans, and every day I get up attempting to live in a factual-based reality and having the faith that enough people will come to that. We're living in a state where the governor, who is a Rhodes Scholar, claims to believe in or allow creationism. The state legislature wants to make the Bible the state book. They ought to read it first. Meanwhile, millions of gallons are pumped out of our aquifer by the industries on the Mississippi River, and they want to block a suit against the 97 companies who have damaged our coast. It kind of points out where the corruption lies, you know, and where the idiocy lies. Thank you.
All right, Mike.
And just amen to his first comments. Yes, it's. I agree with him totally. Now, the point about the environmental suit is different. That doesn't involve the same issues. But, yes, I think he's correct.
Well, we look forward to having another visit with you sometime very soon. And thank you so much for joining us, as always.
Thank you, Jim.
Michael Wolff. Take care. 297-5633 is your number, and we're joined by Ayelet Waldman. She is the author of several novels and is back with a vengeance from her perch in Berkeley, California. And she has gotten rave reviews for the latest work, Love and Treasure. One review says, Ayeled accomplishes a deft feat in her new book. Her elegant, sweeping Holocaust novel does not once visit the concentration camps, but still conveys the scope of the tragedy as well as the richness of Hungarian Jewish history, and in particular, the Hungarian trains that were in existence during the World War II years. Good morning to you, Ayeled Waldman.
Good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here this morning.
Well, it's nice to visit with you. And this is a fascinating time in world history, and you, through your exhaustive research, which included more than a few trips abroad, have unearthed some nuggets that perhaps you and the rest of us didn't know that much about.
It's true, and it's so funny when you spend years working on a book that you think is just completely obscure, and then, you know, a month or so before your book comes out, George Clooney makes a movie about a similar issue. It was actually kind of great when Monuments Men came out, because the whole issue of art and the Holocaust kind of percolated to the surface of people's consciousness. I found this story when I was just sort of noodling around on the internet about this thing called the Hungarian Gold Train, which was a train full of property, of gold and silver and carpets and furs and china and crystal and stamp collections, pretty much anything you can imagine, from the most valuable to the least valuable sort of household goods and personal property, was loaded onto this train in Hungary. And then it kind of wandered around Europe as the war came to a close, one step ahead of various invading armies from all sides, and eventually ended up in the hands of the Americans in Salzburg in Austria in 1945. And it was that story that's kind of the heart of my novel.
How much gold and riches are we talking about?
Well, you know, estimates range to as much as $4 billion in today's currency. I mean, we're talking about the accumulated wealth of the Jewish population of Hungary. And before World War II, the Jews of Hungary were a very wealthy community. I mean, there were definitely poor Jews as well, but virtually all of Hungarian commerce was in the hands of the Hungarian bourgeoisie, and those people were pretty much all Jewish. They were Hungarian noblemen who were the sort of aristocrats who were Catholic, and then they were Hungarian, the peasantry, who were both Jewish and non-Jewish, but the middle class was pretty much Jewish in Hungary, and that middle class had all of their property confiscated by the Nazis and by their Hungarian fascists. Colleagues, and all of it was what wasn't stolen by the people who did the confiscating was sorted and packed and loaded on this train. So imagine, if you will, you know, between 30 and 40 cargo cars full of loot just, you know, trundling from track to track, one sort of step ahead of various armies as the war came to a close. It was really a remarkable story.
And your book focuses on U.S. Army Lieutenant Jack Wiseman. He takes a pendant from the gold train in 1945, and what happens?
Well, so Jack Wiseman, he's a young American Army officer. He's a lieutenant, and then eventually he receives a promotion during the course of that section of the novel. And his job is to guard the plunder, to keep people from looting it. But very quickly, he realizes that his job is also to fill the requisition orders of the top brass. So imagine, if you will, that you're a general and you've been assigned to live in Salzburg, and to be in charge of the Marshall Plan reconstruction of Germany or Austria. So all of these high-ranking American Army officers are there, and they were billeted in these houses of Austrian nobility or very wealthy Austrians. And the first thing the Austrians did when they were forced to turn over their homes was to strip them of all their property. So the American generals would show up, and they would have a beautiful house, but have nothing in it. And this is, you know, the wake of the war, and Austria is in ruins. And you can't just go to the store and buy a set of china. And they needed dishes, they needed towels, they needed linens, they needed stuff. And there's this warehouse full of all of this loot from this train. And the American Army officers start requisitioning it. And there are these, you know, in my research I found these remarkable requisition orders from, you know, Harry Collins requisitioning a service of China for 18. And then eventually what happened was when the American Army officers were sent back home, many of them simply packed up all the stuff they'd requisitioned and took it home with them. And Jack Weissman, the character in my book, is the man in charge of trying to keep that loot safe. And he, in the face of his superior officers, plundering it. And eventually he slips a pendant into his pocket. It's a pendant that reminds him of a young woman that he's fallen in love with, and he has become so demoralized by what he feels like is the sort of wholesale looting that he takes this pendant, and having stolen that pendant plagues him for the rest of his life.
And this is a novel, of course, but what you're talking about, it did happen.
All happened. You know, I made up the specific characters who are my main characters, but there are also many characters in the book who are real, and I tried never to have a real character do anything they wouldn't have done, and certainly I didn't portray negatively any real characters who didn't, you know, misbehave themselves. But there are a lot of, you know, it's a complicated situation because I guess in a way I am accusing many of these generals for looting, but on the other hand, these are men who were heroes. I mean, General Harry Collins, the head of the 42nd Infantry, the Rainbow Division, he liberated Dachau. This is an authentic American hero. But people are complicated, and people can be heroic in battle and do things that maybe in retrospect, once they are out of that kind of fog of war, that don't conform to their personal morality.
And amid the drama about the Hungarian gold train, then and now, the book is in many ways a book about women's rights then and now.
Well, yes, there's a whole section. So the book traces this pendant that Jack took and slipped in his pocket. And at the end of his life, he feels terribly guilty about having done this. And he makes a sort of final request as he's dying of his granddaughter that she try to find who the pendant belonged to or the heir to the pendant because, you know, most of the people whose property was on that train were killed by the Germans. And he gives her this pendant and he says, go to Budapest and find a solution for me. Return it to someone. And she, his granddaughter Natalie, heads off to Budapest and with the help of a complicated, somewhat shady, but ultimately redeemed art dealer, searches for the person to whom the pendant belongs. And in the very last section, I take you back in time to Budapest in 1913, and you find out that the pendant belonged to this young woman, a young Jewish woman who lived in Budapest, who was, in fact, part of the women's suffrage movement. In 1913, Budapest hosted the International Conference of Women's Suffrage. And I found this amazing photographic record of that time. The whole city turned out to welcome all of these women agitating for the right to vote. The mayor deputized the city's Boy Scouts to act as guides for the women throughout the city. So there are these fabulous photographs of these young, I mean, little boys, you know, 9, 10, 11 years old, with these grand lady suffragettes on their arms as they squire them around the city, showing them from cafe to restaurant to back to their lodging rooms. And it's really, the pictures are, I think, you know, they were probably taken just by one or two photographers, but there are hundreds of them, and they're just magnificent.
Well, Iolette Woldman has done it again. She has written other well-received books, Red Hook Road, Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, and an essay collection, Bad Mother. But this one has taken a life of its own, and we'll follow the Hungarian gold train in the Second World War through love and treasure. And we thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure. Louisiana is one of my favorite states.
Well, we're glad to hear that from somebody who's in beautiful California.
All the way in Berkeley, California.
That's a beautiful place, too. Thank you, Iolette.
Bye-bye, Jim.
Take care. Iolette Woldman. And I did get a question from a listener about John Bel Edwards' vote on that anti-sodomy law. He is running for governor as a Democrat. He was one of the 27 who voted to get rid of the the anti-constitutional law. So some might think in Louisiana, a guy from a meet, that may be an act of political courage, and it would be interesting to see how his fellow gubernatorial hopefuls, Jay Darden, the lieutenant governor, and David Vitter, the U.S. senator from Metairie, how do they chime in on this vote? How would they have voted if they were in the Louisiana legislature, both of whom were members at one time? In fact, Darden and Vitter voted on some things together, one in the Senate, one in the House, many years ago. Yours truly will be gone the first 3 days of next week, but we have some great people to sit in the host chair, Robert Travis Scott, Bob Mann, and Michael Dana. And I'll be back Thursday, but hope you'll be listening all week and listen all weekend to WRKF. Thanks for joining us, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.